Shrink Wrap Radio number 438, Exploring a Relational Approach to Autism and Other States of Mind with Dr. Dan L. Edmonds.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with existential psychoanalyst and psychotherapist Dr. Dan L. Edmonds about acceptance and understanding in relation to autism and extreme states of mind. For more information about Dr. Dan Edmonds, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Dan Edmonds, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, I'm pleased to have you on the show. Let's get started by going into your background a bit. I was looking through your website, and I noticed that your master's degree was in theology, and that for a time you worked as a chaplain for the elderly and with veterans. And I was struck by the fact that you were originally ordained in the Eastern Orthodox Church, and then later became involved with a liberal Catholic denomination, and subsequently developed a more pluralistic outlook, becoming interested in Buddhist meditation. So that sounds like quite a journey, and clearly you've had a long history of devotion to the spiritual side of things. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think in the beginning, I had an interest in theological studies, and I wanted to do something as well that would be compassionate and where I could help others. And that later kind of took a different course as I became somewhat disillusioned by some of the things in the church. So I entered into the counseling realm, but I do believe that having that grounding in spirituality before gave me a unique perspective in the work that I do with my clients, whereas others who would have just started from a background as an undergraduate psychology onward probably wouldn't have some of the same perspectives.
Yeah, I have the impression that your work is driven quite a bit by ethical concerns, and I'm wondering what role your theological training and spiritual orientation might have had in that.
I believe it had a major influence. I think that was part of kind of the moral compass that was given to me. And then when I entered the counseling realm, I began to kind of look at, okay, here are some things that are unjust and things that we need to really look at and examine and try to change.
Yeah. Now, two main threads in your recent professional work have been autism and what you refer to as extreme mental states. I'm wondering if you see autism as an example of an extreme mental state, or are these somewhat separate topics?
I look at them as separate. When I say extreme states of mind, what I am referring to is those things that typically labeled as schizophrenia, bipolar, different types of psychoses.
Okay, well, we'll talk about both probably, but let's begin with a consideration of autism. Let's begin with a consideration of autism and your work with autistic persons. How did you become interested in autism?
Actually, it kind of came rather randomly. I was working with an agency, and the director basically asked me if I would have an interest in working with an autistic young man. I really didn't have a whole lot of background at that time, but I did take interest and built a very good connection with him. So later I decided to get further training and awareness of how to connect and reach these individuals. And from there, it became a major part of the work that I'm doing.
Yeah, I'm glad that you shared an example with us, and I want you to feel free to throw in any other examples of your work or case histories or anything as we go along. Now, the example that you just gave us was with a child. Has your work been mostly with autistic children or adults or both?
I've had mainly autistic children, but actually I work with both.
Uh-huh.
And I did have a young man who I worked with through his teen years, and then he ended up into college. And surprisingly, against a lot of things that his teachers and others, they didn't believe that he would be capable of, but he did graduate with his master's degree. And there was a story behind that, too, because he was a peculiar young fellow, and he would make these videos, and one of the things that he would put in them, which this was even before my time, so I wasn't real sure how he even knew about it, but it was lamb chop puppets.
I'm sorry, it was what?
And lamb chop puppets.
Lamb chop puppets.
Yeah, so he would act out these scenes with these puppets. Now, his family initially just thought it was just random silliness, and they didn't pay a whole lot of mind to it. So I sat down with him one time, and I went through, and I watched these videos very intently. And what he was doing was acting out actual events in his life with the puppets. So he had experienced some bullying and so forth, and so he was demonstrating that with the puppets. But he was very creative and clever with video production.
Mm-hmm.
So that, when he decided to go off to college, that's what I encouraged him to look into. I said, you know, you're very good at this. You might want to consider that. So that's what he ended up graduating with, was a degree in this video production.
Wow. Now, I want to make sure I understood you. Did you say he was using lamb chop puppets? And I know there used to be a puppeteer, and I think she had a character called Lamb Chop. So,
yes, that was the one.
Okay,
her name was Sherry Lewis.
Okay, good. Yes. And actually, there was a time when Sherry Lewis was actually a listener to this series. I don't know if she listens anymore, but I hope that she does. So, I'm wondering if you know, I think a lot of people probably have a fixed image in their minds about autism of non-improvement. And so what kinds of change or development or growth or improvement do you see among the kids and the adults that you work with who are autistic?
I've often seen communication being enhanced, relationship being enhanced, which I think is important. I've been able to see them use their strengths and passions in a way that actually works for them. I've seen where they develop more functional independence, more autonomy, and I think those are all very important things.
Yeah. When I spoke to Nick Walker, and he directed me to some readings by autistic people as well, and I was struck to see that over time, I almost got the impression that some people almost grow out of it in terms of communication skills and so on.
I have seen that in some situations where younger children had some severe delays communication-wise, and then later down the road you would not even be aware that those communication problems even existed.
Yeah. So what do you see as the principles that are key in supporting autistic persons?
The principles that I looked at, it's kind of what I mentioned before, is the presuming intellect, looking at behavior as a form of communication, encouraging autonomy, and also listening to self-advocates, and offering support in a way that is respectful and dignified. And not based on any type of idea that we're trying to alter the person to be something that they're not nor need to be.
What's been your experience working with the parents of autistic children? I have the impression that there's some thinking within the autistic community that well-meaning parents sometimes end up inadvertently stigmatizing or supporting the stigmatization of autistic children. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, fortunately, the parents that I have encountered were those that wanted to use a relational approach. But I've also encountered these parents who have not been able to accept their children for who they are, and they're searching for this idea of, okay, we need to make our child be normal, whatever that term may actually mean. And I think that's a problem. And I've encountered some parents that because they haven't been able to accept their children for who they are, sometimes will inadvertently use terminology that can be actually very denigrating.
Yeah. Is there an example of that that comes to mind?
Well, I remember encountering through an autism support group that there was one parent who actually said that they felt that their child was defective. And so I think that's a very damaging term and not supportive or helpful at all to say that they are somehow defective, because it implies that they're also somehow less than human.
Yeah. Now, there are neuroscientists who consider autism to be a brain disorder and are hoping to eventually find a, quotes, cure. What's your opinion about that? Do you have a problem with that perspective?
I do have a problem with that because, as I said before, I'm not looking at it as a disease. I'm looking at it as a mode of being. This is simply how a person behaves. So, honestly, I'm not really all that interested in the supposed causation. And we hear it's all over the place. Sometimes we're hearing all of these vaccines, it's genetic. There was a recent article that said it was air pollution. It's all over the place with these different concepts. But I look at the bottom line is simply that mode of being and how the person behaves.
Okay, and I believe you've created one or more programs or organizations to support autistic people. What can you tell us about that work?
Yes, I did create an entity to gather persons together that were in the autism spectrum and offer guidance and support to them. And the other organization which I established back in 2006 was the Center for Humane Psychiatry, and the purpose of that was to work on mental health reform and try to make some changes with the psychiatric establishment.
Good. Sounds like good work. Now, in terms of autism specifically, have there been any thinkers, authors, researchers who have influenced your thinking?
I would say that Stanley Greenspan, the relational approach, so there were some aspects of what he had to say that has had some influence in my work. There was also Sakis, who was into existential therapy with autistic kids, so I am aware of some of what he did in the past. But I do think that is the unfortunate thing, is that relational approach is certainly a dignified approach, and it also is something that that really does help the person. But unfortunately, it seems that the majority of the programs tend to be more focused on this behavioralist approach, which is usually taught in behavioral manipulation.
Right. How do you feel about such organizations as Autism Speaks? For our listeners out there, I want to apologize for the quality of our Skype connection. I know that it's gotten hard to listen to or hard to hear clearly at some points. And so we've just now reconnected on Skype, and hopefully your listening experience will be better. So taking it up again, Dr. Edmonds, let me ask you, how do you feel about such organizations as Autism Speaks?
The problem with Autism Speaks is that none of the individuals involved in that organization actually are autistic, so they're not really speaking for autistic people at all. Another part of their philosophy is based on looking at autistic persons as defective and in need of being altered. So I would not really support such an organization. I think a better organization to support would be what is known as the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, which is actually run by persons who are autistic.
Okay, well, let's shift our focus to your views on and your work with extreme states of mind. What's been your approach towards helping those through extreme states of mind? And I guess before you answer that, I really should ask you what you mean by that expression, extreme states of mind.
When I say extreme states of mind, this is what commonly is labeled as psychotic disorder, schizophrenia, and also bipolar. So in my work there, once again, it's a relational approach, and basically trying to understand the experience of the individual and to look at some of the root cause of what is leading to some of the behaviors that they may be exhibiting. And usually what I found with a lot of individuals who are in extreme states that at some point they experience very significant traumatic events. And what I noticed, too, is that they were always telling me the truth. However, many times what they were saying was steeped in very deep metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
So it was for me to try to connect with them and understand the language that they were speaking and what they were trying to convey to me. I remember one instance, there was a young man who had been in the state hospital, and his mother was trying to get him released from that facility, and she asked me to meet with him. So I sat down with him for a time, and he was a very friendly, pleasant individual, but initially he began to say some things to me that I had known prior that most in the establishment had completely dismissed it as just ramblings.
Yeah.
So he was Caucasian, but he had told me that he was actually born African-American, and he was bleached white at 2 years old.
Uh-huh.
And that he felt that he was being controlled, that he could not think for himself. And so he said, and he used the metaphor of frequencies, that he was being controlled by these frequencies. So I began to examine his experience a little bit and found out that the person who had him committed to the facility was his father, who had been in racist organizations and had begun physically abusing him when he was about 2 years old.
Wow.
So if I put all of that together, I determined that what he was telling me was true, and but was all steeped in a very metaphorical way. I had another woman who came to see me, and she was very convinced with this delusion that she was Mary Magdalene. So it took long, intensive time to understand her and to kind of conduct her back to the world of everyone else. But in my approach, I did not challenge the delusion and say, okay, well, you're not Mary Magdalene. How could you think such a thing? But I began to explore, well, what is it like to be Mary Magdalene? What is that experience? Why are you Mary Magdalene? And over time, I began to understand a little bit about her childhood, particularly her adolescent years, and some of the things that she had experienced. And she later went through a religious revival, so it made sense that she connected with that story, but it got a little bit overboard where, rather than just connecting to it, she basically absorbed the identity of that person. But amazingly, after about a year and a half, she was able to realize that she was not this person, and she realized, came to the realization of why she connected with that story. She ended up off of all the antipsychotic medications that she was on, and she ended up marrying and having two children, who did remarkably well after going through some very, very difficult experiences.
And what's your attitude towards psychopharmacological interventions for people who are in these extreme states?
Well, I believe that persons should have the ability to have choice in the matter. If they decide that, and they've been given informed consent and they want to take these medications, that's entirely up to them. However, I prefer, if possible, to avoid these things at all costs, because I see that there's a lot of very damaging adverse effects that can come from them, for one. Plus, they are simply just suppressing and shutting down the experience. And I think that rather than suppressing, we really need to work through it and get to the root of where is this coming from? How did this person become lost along the way?
Yeah, so how did you come to adopt this approach? Was there any particular person or author who influenced you to approach things this way?
It began with just having some experiences with those that were going through the extreme states, and I saw and was very disturbed by how I saw some within the establishment interacting with these persons, that they would be maybe in an appointment for 15 minutes, and there was really no examination of their experience at all. It was basically just looking at, okay, here's your symptoms, you fit into this category, and here is your prescription, have a nice day, and that was the end of it. So I began to think, okay, there has to be a more human approach than that. And then later I began reading the works of R.D. Lang.
Right. He was definitely coming to mind. Go ahead.
So familiarizing myself with his earlier work that he did during the 60s and 70s, I really connected with that and felt that, you know, unfortunately, some of his approach had basically become kind of forgotten. So I looked at this, that's what needs to be done, is to revive that humane approach. But I think what we have now is this biological model that really is reductionist, and it doesn't really look at the wholeness of the person.
Yeah, and I believe that R.D. Lang was part of something known as radical psychiatry, or that there was a movement that's kind of was identified by that expression. And just as with the autism group that you mentioned, with that's being run by people who are autistic, that there are also organizations and websites and so on that are primarily run by people who have been diagnosed with psychosis of one sort or another.
Right. And the interesting thing, too, is that within the medical field, you never hear of different survivor movements except with psychiatry, where you have individuals who felt that they were actually harmed and have banded together to support one another. And one thing that I have often said in regards to how psychiatry operates is that with most medicine, they are inventing new drugs to be able to target various disorders. But with psychiatry, they are basically inventing new disorders and give existing drugs.
I like that. I haven't heard it put quite that way before.
And I see that as a problem, too, that we're, when the original DSM arose, I believe there is maybe 50 or so disorders listed. Now we're up to around 400 or so. And it's becoming that any human experience is almost becoming a pathology. So it's going to come to a point, if it continues, where probably every single person could be labeled with some disorder or more than one disorder.
Okay, now I hope you're speaking loudly and clearly into your phone because the sound quality is starting to degrade again. But let's see if we can keep going.
Okay. Yeah, I'm good.
You see, that makes a big... Yeah, it is. So there's some way in which you're forgetting to... either the phone is moving away from your mouth or something. So that's really good.
Okay, we're good. All right.
Okay, good. So let's see here. I'm wondering if you know, how people find you, how they get referred to you, if you've developed something of a reputation for the way that you work with people who are autistic or in extreme states of mind.
I believe that because my approach is unique, I have kind of developed a reputation for being a little bit unorthodox in my approach to some degree, but also offering a more humane approach. So I've had a number that have discovered me through some of my writings and so forth that I've had out there. So I get referrals usually through those means.
Yes, and what is the International Center for Humane Psychiatry, and what's your involvement with that?
Back in 2006, because of some of the objections that I had things that I was seeing within the mental health system, and particularly, as I mentioned, kind of this reductionist idea and really not validating experience, I wanted to kind of create a network of psychiatric survivors as well as professionals who could band together and try to offer a more humane approach and also to offer kind of a critical thought on some of what's going on.
And so is there a website or something that's associated with that is still going on and live that people might look into that?
There is a website.
Yeah, what is that?
It's psyche.healthwise.org.
Okay, great. And do you believe that recovery from extreme states is possible?
I absolutely believe that because I have witnessed and seen it happen. And I've asked the question frequently to those that are in this biopsychiatric model that when I mentioned these individuals, they said, well, you're saying that this is going to be a lifelong disorder that they are not able to recover from, and they're going to need to be consumers of psychiatric drugs indefinitely. How do you explain these individuals who actually did recover? I said, did one day their brain chemistry just shifted in some way that worked out for them, or what happened? And the fact of the matter is, no one will really provide me that answer. But I know myself exactly what happened. That it was, I would compare it to like a shamanic voyage. That this person is lost, the fragments of their being is kind of out there. And so you're having to put all of this back together and then conduct them back to the world of others.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking of a related organization. I'm not certain if they're still alive or not, but there was the Network for Spiritual Emergencies. Maybe there had been a Center for Spiritual Emergencies. I'm not sure. But I think those are people who also are looking at it from, as you say, kind of like a shamanic voyage,
right,
that requires some support and nurturing along the way.
That's another individual who I felt had some influence over some of the thinking that I have now, is Groff, who was involved with that organization that you're mentioning.
Yes, Stan Groff, yes. Yeah, I've interviewed him, actually, in the past. And, very interesting and dynamic and visionary guy.
And I believe another two that I had encountered before he passed away was Lauren Mosher. And he developed a Soteria project where he had individuals in extreme states who lived in a community setting and were on very low amounts of psychiatric medications, or in some instances, none whatsoever.
There's another one I can mention to you, who is John Perry, a Jungian analyst. He's also passed on now, but he had a residential house in San Francisco, as I recall. I believe it was called Chrysalis House. And he wrote a book. I don't remember the title offhand, but you might want to look him up on Amazon.
I'm familiar.
Oh, you are? Good. Yes. Yeah, so you've definitely got some intellectual support out there, some intellectual and emotional support for this direction.
Now, one thing I had thought about, too, but ethically would not be able to carry this out. But back in the day, there was the Rosenhan study, where he took himself and students and got themselves admitted into a state hospital.
Yes.
And they were there. He was thinking that if any of them got admitted, there wouldn't be very many, and they wouldn't be there for very long. But some of them were there for a very lengthy period of time, and all of them were admitted.
And I recall that the symptom that they got admitted for was saying that they heard a voice that said thud.
Right, right. And then there was a follow-up where the psychiatrist basically said, well, this is kind of a fluke, so they asked him to send more people in. And so they wrote back identifying who they thought were pseudo patients, but the fact of the matter was that Rosenhan didn't send anybody.
Oh, my goodness.
So it really challenged the credibility of diagnosis. So
yeah.
What I always thought would be interesting these days is that if you took a group of children into a psychiatric center and all you said is that they jump around a lot, and that's all you said, how many of those children would be labeled ADHD and probably given a stimulus? And I would bet it would be all of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't take that bet. I wouldn't want to bet against it. So what do you believe to be the root cause of emotional distress?
Well, in the one book that I wrote called The Meeting of Two Persons, what I discussed there was that there's social issues, there are familial issues, and there's even political issues. So people who are disadvantaged are going to be more likely to be in situations of distress. I do believe that the different forms of trauma is very significant in shaping these situations of distress.
Yeah, so back when I was an intern and I worked in the VA hospital, and it seemed like any time that you looked into the case history of the kind of family environment, neighborhood environment that people grew up in, it seemed like there was almost always a strong history of trauma. Now, I may be conflating this a little bit, actually. I may be thinking of the prison system, actually, where I know it's the case that in prisons that early childhood trauma is extremely, if not universally, present.
Right. And the other group of young people that I have been working with, too, is those with attachment concerns. And that is always rooted in neglect, abuse, and very traumatic situations as well.
Yeah. So how would you change the methods of care for those in emotional distress today? If you had a huge government grant, say, what would you do with it?
Well, the first thing that I think is important is to allow the person to have some type of voice in their treatment as to what is actually going to happen. To eliminate these ideas of force and coercion. So that's a key thing. I believe that we have to start becoming less reliant on psychiatric drugs and psychiatric intervention and focus more just on our common humanness and to be able to have a system that actually is accessible, that takes the time to actually walk through these difficult things that a person might be dealing with. And that's the unfortunate thing, that I see that particularly for those that are disadvantaged, they get the short end of things. They're basically, nobody is going to spend a whole lot of time validating that experience, hearing it out, working through it. They're basically, it's going to be more of just a psychopharmacological intervention. So I think those are kind of the key things that need to happen to change the system around.
Yes, and now you mentioned, we've mentioned a couple of books that you have written, and I believe you also co-authored a book titled Mystical Metaphors. Who's your co-author, and what's that one about?
That actually was an interesting story as to how that arose. It was a university student from New Zealand who kept a journal while he was going through a very difficult time and in an extreme state of mind. So he asked me if he could send me this journal and if I would look through it and offer commentary and tell him what I might think of what his experience was. So I did that and sent it back to him. And he told me, he said, no one ever really paid much mind to this or really understood what I was trying to say. And he said, your commentary was right on target with where I was at that particular time.
Wow,
so we
great.
So we decided to put that out. So there's that book. There's also an article that I wrote called The Journey Through Madness. And in that, I was trying to detail and be as faithful as possible to the actual experience of these persons, what they actually encountered. But what I found that I had to do, I didn't want to just put this out there without first consulting with people who actually went through these experiences. So I found three persons who had recovered, and I shared it with them, and I said, does this connect with where you were at? And they agreed that it did. So once I got that confirmation, then I ended up printing the article.
Where would a person find that article?
I have it on the, I have a Psychology Today blog titled Extreme States of Mind. It can be found there. And I also have it, there's the Psychology Tomorrow magazine. It's online, and it's listed there, too.
Okay, great. I'm sure that's enough of a clue for people to find it. Now, as we wind down here, I wonder if there's anything you'd like to add by way of summary.
All I will summarize with is that that I'm hoping that individuals will be able to come together and that we will be able to create a more humane mental health system, and that and that people, particularly with the autism spectrum, that they will be able to gain more of an understanding and an acceptance of these individuals and not look at them as somehow apart or defective or somehow less than human.
Okay, well, that's a good reminder and a good call to remember to change our attitudes, some of which are just deeply ingrained in our culture and in the ways that we've been programmed by the system, so to speak. So Dr. Dan L. Edmonds, I want to thank you for your patience today in with the audio difficulties we were having, and I also want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yes, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Clearly, Dr. Dan Edmonds and I share common existential and humanistic philosophical roots. I have to admire his commitment to encountering his autistic clients as well as those suffering from psychosis on their own terms. I also admire his willingness to look beyond their symptoms and behaviors and to be alert to underlying meanings expressed through metaphor. It was his discussion of metaphor that triggered Jungian associations for me. I mentioned the work of Jungian analyst John Weir Perry, who created a sort of halfway house for psychotic individuals in San Francisco. I incorrectly called that facility Chrysalis House. In fact, a little research after the interview reveals that the name was Diabasis House. Any listeners who are interested in learning more about Dr. Perry's approach and the experience at Diabasis will be interested in reading his book, Far Side of Madness. According to that book's page on Amazon.com, and I quote, "When The Far Side of Madness was first published in 1974, John Weir Perry's deep insight into the nature of so-called schizophrenia opened the way for a radically new, more compassionate approach to this condition. The pioneering work of Jungian psychiatry reframes acute psychotic episodes in the context of visionary experience of schizophrenic patients and describes innovative methods of handling them," close quote. Similarly, listeners might be interested in another of Dr. Perry's books, The Self in Psychotic Process, Its Symbolization in Schizophrenia. As one reviewer on the Amazon site points out, and I quote, "C.G. Jung started as a psychiatrist learning from schizophrenic patients. Among the Jungian school, only John W. Perry has continued this line of work with such depth of understanding, clinical acumen, and the ability to write beautifully. Perry's therapy in the California Bay Area with acute episodes in young psychotic patients brought him national and international renown. The case of the young housewife diagnosed catatonic schizophrenic demonstrates the interpretation of collective symbols and individual processes as they come to light in a breakdown, and extends knowledge of the psyche by elucidating symbols of the self." Close quote. As you heard in the interview, today's guest, Dr. Edmonds, is an author as well, having written The Meeting of Two Persons, What Therapy Should Be, and Being Autistic, An Approach Towards Acceptance and Understanding, and he's a co-author of Mystical Metaphors. Any or all of these books can be ordered using the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site.
I have a confession to make. I am a shrink wrap radio addict. That's right. Dr. Dave has me totally hooked. I'm devouring episode after episode, so I figured it's only fair to make a donation. And, you know, if you're enjoying these shows too, perhaps you should think about making a donation, maybe even just a one-off one. Every little bit helps. Go on, you know it'll make you feel good.
Thank you, Louise Callanan, there down under. You've been such a long-time supporter, and I can't tell you how much that means to me. If you aren't already on the donor honor roll on our website, how about making that commitment and getting your name up there right away for the whole Shrink Wrap Radio community to see and to derive inspiration from your action? Let me take a moment to announce recent additions to our donor honor roll. My thanks go out to Marden International Limited, Marion Morgan, Greg Nelson, and Linda Schuler. Now, speaking of this honor roll, we've entered a new year, 2015. It would take too much bookkeeping for me to figure out who donated when. So one day soon, I'm going to clear off the board and start listing only donations which come in during this current year of 2015. So all of you who are making current regular donations should see your name up there by the end of this month. Those of you who make an occasional donation will need to make another one this year to get your name back up there. And the same for those of you who donate $12 for the year. Now, I hope no one will feel slighted by this. Again, I'm so appreciative of your support. Speaking of support, I do hope you'll take a look at the list of book banner ads from past interviewees that appear in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. They pay a small fee for the privilege of my posting an ad for their book there, and I want to make sure they're getting their money's worth and that some of you are buying the occasional book there. A few that have been recently added are The Brain Savvy Therapist Workbook by Dr. Bonnie Badenoch, Embracing Envy, Finding the Spiritual Treasure in Our Most Shameful Emotion by Dr. Josh Gressel, TA Today, A New Introduction to Transactional Analysis, second edition, and that's by recent guest Van Joynes. And another one in which he's a co-author is called Personality Adaptations, A New Guide to Human Understanding in Psychotherapy and Counseling. And finally, we have the recent interview with Simon Cole in France, and the title of the book was Stillness in Mind. So I do so appreciate these people advertising on our site. And if you click on the link that you'll see in the right-hand sidebar, it will take you right to their book and to where you can purchase it. Last time I mentioned that we have two new continuing education courses offered through the Zur Institute, and they are Holistic and Nutritional Approaches to Treating Psychological Disorders for 5 CEUs and Holistic Psychotherapy, Treating the Whole Person for 6 CEUs. They sound a little bit similar, don't they? Well, how about grouping those two together with some other relevant ones? And so I'm pleased to announce that there is a new 43-unit certificate course that includes the two above, plus additional material. And that 43-unit course is called Complementary and Alternative Medicine. So to see the details, go to http://www.zurinstitute.com/online_certificates. And I believe you can find that on our website somewhere as well. And remember, you can get 10% off any and all Zur Institute courses using the discount code DrDave88, which is spelled DrDave88. And speaking of discounts, our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is also offering a discount on a course on alchemy with Jungian analysts Robbie Bosnack and Patricia Berry, both of whom you've heard me interview here, so you know how fabulous they are. And this 10-session course is spread out over 2 years, and you can attend the 10 live webinar sessions, or, you'll also receive audio recordings of all of these sessions. So you'll get it one way or the other, or both ways. Now you can find the dates and other details on our Shrink Wrap Radio website under the Partners tab. And the cost of the course is $150, but you can receive a 15% off discount by using the discount code DrDave, which again is just DrDave. Finally, let me remind you of our affiliate relationship with Audible.com, where if you're not already a member, you can get a free book of your choice from their more than 165,000 titles. I'm a huge fan of Audible because for so many years, I've always had an Audible book going to listen to in my car or on walks. As a matter of fact, in just a few minutes, I'm going to go on one of those walks and I'm going to listen to the latest book that I just downloaded. And I want to thank you, so many of you who have gone ahead and signed up for this program. So my current recommendation for you based on today's interview, is the book The Myth of Autism, How a Misunderstood Epidemic is Destroying Our Children. It's unabridged, and it's by Dr. Michael Goldberg and Elise Goldberg. And with that, you get 7 hours and 19 minutes of in-depth information. And I think this one fits nicely with today's interview. And if you're not already an Audible subscriber, it can be yours to keep just by going to audibletrial.com/shrink.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the bod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Okay, that was another musical chestnut from the past, thanks to Nashville musician Jeff Smith. By the way, if any of you out there are musicians, I could use some fresh content of this sort. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. I'll read just one today, and it reads, "Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Sebastian. I'm from Melbourne, Australia. I've been a listener and a contributor to your podcast for about 2 years now. I'm not a psychologist or have any type of training in the area. I'm just a layman interested in all sorts of things, and through your podcast, I've learned a lot about how people think, and especially how I think. So I just wanted to say thank you for your great work and continued efforts. I've also purchased several books from guests you interviewed as a result of hearing them on your show. However, I'm afraid these purchases have gone uncommissioned as I didn't use your Amazon affiliate link to buy them. Amazon's pricing with shipping to Australia can be quite high, and I tend to buy a lot of books from thebookdepository.com instead. They have free shipping to anywhere in the world, and their prices are about the same as Amazon. I'm not sure if your Amazon affiliation allows a competing site, but it might be useful for your international listeners if you could also have a bookdepository.com affiliation link for us to use. Thanks again." And that's from Sebastian. He signs it Sab. Well, Sab, thanks so much for being such a loyal listener and a contributor to the show. I really appreciate that. And I understand the issue that you're describing with Amazon. And I have to say, I heard similar feedback some years back from Australians, and as a result, did have a bookdepository.com affiliation link. So I thought I would try to revive it. However, I can't seem to find it. It would be great if I could just somehow recover the link I used to have and get it back up that way. So I think what I need to do is maybe see if I can find it using the Wayback Machine, and maybe that'll give me the graphic that I had before. So I will commit to trying to get that going. One of the reasons I let go of it, though, is I didn't have the impression that it was generating very much income, and I thought it was just taking up space and maybe not getting used. But I'm willing to rethink that. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and I hope you will. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. And again, I hope you will. Once again, thanks to Dr. Dan L. Edmonds for sharing his orientation and expertise on autism and other states of mind. My next interview will be with Washington Post journalist Tom Schroeder, and we'll be discussing his new book dealing with psychedelics and their power to heal. So I hope you will join us, and until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.